Hi, Blaine. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing very well, although, I did lose a couple of nights' sleep here reading your book. I live out in the country and it's quiet out there, and all of a sudden I was listening to little noises at the door.
Sorry to hear that.
No, it's
I guess that
all
means I
good
did a
fun.
good job as a writer, though.
You absolutely did. We're talking about Murder in Battle Creek, The Mysterious Death of Daisy Zick. But before I start talking about the book, one thing that intrigued me, Blaine, was that I read somewhere that you have some 60 titles to your name. Is that true?
I've written a lot of books over the years, yes.
You're not that old.
Well, it's a hobby. I actually work full time for a national accounting and consultancy firm. I do my writing at night and on the weekends. And I write in a lot of different genres. Matter of fact, I just had a business management book come out 2 weeks ago. So I write about the things that I read and enjoy reading.
Okay. Well, this one is a crime story, and there are a lot of crime stories out there and a lot of cold cases. What caught your attention about the story of Daisy Zick?
What really compelled me was everywhere I went, I was working on another book, another true crime book called Secret Witness, and everywhere I went, people brought up Daisy Zick to me. I didn't go looking for this; they brought it up to me. I was actually raised in Wattles Park, outside Battle Creek, Michigan, where this took place. So this really took place about a mile and a half from my house. I didn't know much about it, and there were a lot of rumors going around about the case. And it seemed to stick with people in Battle Creek, mostly because it had taken place with an employee at Kellogg's, and Kellogg's had played kind of a role in the investigation. It was such a brutal crime. I mean, we're talking about someone stabbed over 20 times.
Wow.
This was such a horrific crime, and it had remained open. So over the years, the rumors and speculation took more credence than probably the actual story itself. And people seemed genuinely to want to know what was going on with it. So for me, anything that grabs people's attention and holds on after 50 years,
Yeah.
and is still kind of gnawing at people, I knew would be a good subject for a book. It's a little bit harder to do a true crime book that's on a cold case. Most true crime books, they walk you through kind of a pattern. There's a crime, the investigation, the arrest, the trial, you get that closure. And with this one, it was a little bit trickier because this case remains open to this day.
Yeah.
So, as a writer, I really had to kind of walk the line almost between what's a murder mystery and a true crime book and say, well, here's all the facts. You tell me who you think did it.
Yeah. Well, it was possibly in the foreword there or the intro that I read in the book, there were some startling numbers that back 50 years ago, Daisy's murder was one of 283 in Michigan. And back then, I believe it said 91% of them were solved. Whereas today, when we're all watching CSI and these forensic shows on TV, you get this impression that crimes are easier to solve than ever. But the numbers seem to be going completely, and that's where I started losing some sleep, that only, what was it, 24% had closure on them?
Yeah, it's really surprising, and a lot of that is there's a lot more crime than there was then.
True.
And unfortunately, depending on where your jurisdiction is and what the tax dollars are available, police have really taken a hit everywhere in terms of their abilities to, continue pursuing cases or even pursue cold cases actively. They do still, if you call in with a tip, even on a case that's 50 years old, they still pursue it, but they don't have a lot of the money that they used to have to be actively engaging and pursuing on these things. It's a real sad state, and it's part of the economy that we've been going through for the past few years.
Yeah. And you decided to use real names. So you could have used fictional ones. And you talked a little bit about why did you decide to use real names in when you wrote it?
Well, that's a great question. My editor and I struggled a little bit with this, and the real reason we did it is this remains an open case. And I try to be as blunt as possible up front with the book that, you know, this doesn't imply that anybody is guilty or not guilty. You know, this is simply, I'm presenting the facts as they appear in the actual case files that the police did with for this particular murder. My thought was, if you provide the names, it might trigger a memory with someone.
Yeah.
And they may say, oh my gosh, I remember talking to that guy that day and or that girl that day, and it clicked with me that this potentially is, you know, somehow connected. And by putting the names out there, I think it lays everything bare for the community, and it may yet still turn up a tip that allow the police to close this case.
Oh, that would be fascinating. Has any of that, and I realize the book hasn't been out that long, but has any of that happened or during your research? Were you getting any tips called into you or emailed to you? Or?
Yes. I was surprised by that at first. When you write, I'm an author. I'm not a law enforcement person. And it was interesting that people would call me up and say, well, let me tell you what I know. And they tell me as a total stranger, here's my tip on this. And I think it's a great testimony about how powerful social media like Twitter and Facebook are, that, you know, I was able to reach out and let people know I was working on the book and they responded. Mm-hmm. I put a couple of those tips in the book. I reached out to the police with those tips. Yeah, I'm not here to solve this case. My job is to say this. I'm here to tell the story of this case. You know, the police are really the ones that need to solve it. And it was a very different circumstance for me to have to reach out to law enforcement and say, I'm getting these tips. You need to be able to follow up on those. And they were very interested in every tip that I passed to them, no matter how ridiculous some of those were. And I think that's a testimony of the officers that are still working this case generation after generation, that they want to see it brought to conclusion as well.
Is that typical for cold cases, or is it just that somebody like you has championed it and kept it alive?
You know, this case, even as of 2001, it was around the last time there was activity on the case where a tip had come in or a lead had come in. I think, you know, an author like myself, I can stir things up. I can generate interest and get dialogue started on this. You know, I think it naturally stirs some things up to the surface. So it helps. But, you know, I found with the law enforcement officers, almost to the person, you know, nothing gnaws at them more than a brutal crime like this going unsolved. And they want it closed. Whether, I doubt this case could ever go to trial with all of the witnesses, you know, having passed away by now. But they can close the case. You know, they can potentially bring closure to Daisy Zick's family. And that's, I think, an important part to that. And I think that's something that almost every law enforcement officer that I spoke to, they all resonated with that story, that they wanted to see this closed, that the family deserved it.
You know, Blaine, for those listeners who haven't yet had the pleasure or the scary pleasure of reading your book, can you give us a quick, short synopsis of what the book is about?
Oh, certainly. In 1963, January 14th, Daisy Zick, who was an employee at the Kellogg's Corporation, was at her home. She worked the afternoon shift. Someone went to her door. It was one of the coldest days of the year. It was literally a below zero day. And whoever it was did not drive to her house. They were either dropped off or had walked to her house in Wattles Park, which is outside of Battle Creek. They went into her house. They had a struggle with Daisy in the house. They cut the telephone line and had incapacitated Daisy to the point where they had tied her hands behind her back. And at some point then they had begun stabbing Daisy. She made a break for it. She fought and made a break to the back bedroom where she was cornered against the wall and eventually was stabbed there, collapsed on the floor, and then apparently the killer actually straddled the body and continued to viciously stab her. The killer then left the house, taking Daisy's car, drove it up on East Michigan Avenue, which is one of the busiest thoroughfares, you know, cutting across Calhoun County, abandoned the car in broad daylight, and disappeared. No less than three witnesses saw the killer in some way, shape, or form that day. But to this day, that crime remains open. And a lot of the book is really focused on the investigation that was done. And it was good, to your point, it was good old-fashioned police work. It isn't DNA testing and a lot of CSI-type stuff. It's regular, good old-fashioned police work. And how generations of officers have had to step in to continue to pursue this. And they were still actively pursuing it, you know, even into this century. We're in the year of the 50th anniversary of this crime, and it really is one of those that resonates within the community, mostly because the Kellogg's Corporation became kind of a focus for this, because that's where Daisy worked. She had, I don't want to say a promiscuous lifestyle, but she had a rather loose lifestyle for 1963. She had several affairs, and because of that, a lot of people at Kellogg's were pulled in, polygraphed, fingerprinted, things along those lines. And despite this massive dragnet that's taken place, the killer has remained elusive to the investigators.
It's intriguing, too, that you present theories that it could be a man, it could be a woman. We're not used to thinking of murderers, especially such brutal ones, as being women. But and you mentioned that she was promiscuous. And it does seem like this is a crime of passion, that there wasn't that much reason to think of robbery in this case, correct?
Yeah, Daisy's husband worked in a meat market in Battle Creek, and she worked at Kellogg's. I mean, her paycheck was $40-some dollars a week. These were not people of wealth. These were just working-class people. Whoever went and did this, they did it strictly with the intent of inflicting harm on Daisy, and in many sense, in a greater sense, they overkilled Daisy.
Yeah.
You know, it's the brutality of the crime definitely speaks to a crime of passion. The investigators over the years have kind of waffled between whether it could be a man or a woman. Most of the witnesses who saw the killer that day describe the killer as a man. There's no way to know for sure. If you think about how cold a Michigan day can be, you know, when it's at zero,
sure, yeah,
you're bundled up, it would be easy to confuse some men and some women, you know, depending on what they're wearing in terms of styles. But most believe it was a man that did this. But as one investigator told me, he said in 1963, the concept that a woman might just was alien and foreign to us. And there were some investigators like Gary Hogue, who lives up in the UP at this point, who had worked the case in the 1990s. He really shifted the focus back and said, well, maybe this was the wife of someone that Daisy had an affair with, or someone who jilted, you know, lover of some sort that wanted to get back at her, and really took that focus. But despite all of that, the crime scene just doesn't paint us an accurate picture of whether it's a man or a woman. It really doesn't tell us the whole story of what happened that day.
Well, there was a scene, the murder scene, where you mentioned that there's a wingtip shoe that's found without a partner's shoe, a white button. Maybe I missed it, but I don't think they ever get mentioned again. Do you know what I'm referring to?
Yeah, the wingtip shoe, I never was in the police reports, but was mentioned to me by one of the officers that I found. When they were checking in the house, they opened the register vents to see if anything had been hidden in the registers, not necessarily by the killer, but maybe by the victim. And they found a wingtip shoe stuck in the register vent. It didn't match anybody who lived in the house. Nobody knew how long it had been there. Mm. That never made the evidence list. There was a white button that was recovered in Daisy's bedroom. and they checked all of Daisy's clothing and all of her husband's clothing. The button didn't match. That button's still on file with Michigan State Police in their evidence room that they maintain this material in. Mm-hmm. But the assumption being it may have been the killer's. Now, whether that button could be matched up to any piece of clothing today,
yeah,
after 50 years, chances are the shirt or article that went to is long gone. But there was a lot of evidence there that just never fully told the story of everything that occurred in that house.
Yeah. There was also a tremendous reliance back in the 60s on polygraph tests and this one print that they found in the car. And I noticed that a lot of these suspects were let go because their print didn't match up. And I had to think, you know, maybe that wasn't even the murderer's print, that so many people that seemed so likely were let go. Do you think they relied on polygraph and that one print a little too much?
I don't think they had a lot of choice. The one print that was found, they found a lot of prints in the car, and they were able to rule out a lot of the prints by people who had adjusted a rearview mirror. You leave a fingerprint, and they were able to find the people that they were associated with. There was one fingerprint pulled from the car on the door, and the assumption was that was the killer's print. And based on where the print was on the car door, the thought was that if anybody else had been driving the car, they would have superimposed or ruined that print. Mm. I tend to favor, you know, the same thing you do, which is in the 1960s, it wasn't uncommon to have a serviceman drive your car into the garage, do the oil change.
Sure.
There's a lot of people that could have touched that car in over the course of time, and it could be that one fingerprint had nothing whatsoever to do with the crime.
Yeah.
Polygraphs, you know, those were very popular to use. And I had an officer explain it to me this way. He said, you can't beat the polygraph, but you can beat the operator. The polygraph doesn't lie, but depending on the question that is asked of you on the polygraph,
right,
and the skill of the operator in interpreting what the feedback is, it is possible to miss that. But in the 1960s, especially the early 60s, this was a common way to be able to try to rule out people. I tend to favor the polygraph probably would have caught someone, whereas the fingerprint, we just have we can't 100% say that fingerprint was really from the killer.
Hmm. So after all this time that you spent researching this book, this murder case, you must have a theory of your own. Do you favor any of the theories that are presented, or any of the suspects really stick out to you?
You know, I have to admit there is one, and it's the theory that it was the postman, William Daly.
Yeah.
There's a few reasons for that. I trust the investigators who actually worked the case at the time. And once you get out of the 1960s, the focus really started to fall to William Daly. There were all of the evidence against him is completely circumstantial. So, you know, it could be completely wrong. But, you know, he lied about seeing a person walking along Michigan Avenue at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He lied about Daisy Zick's garage door being open when he delivered mail.
Right.
We know that he had seen Daisy Zick sunbathing nude in the backyard, and I was able to validate with some of the who were then 13-year-old boys who lived next door that Daisy did do that. But having been up by the Zick home and having taken a look at it, etc., there's not any way anybody could have seen that unless they were kind of stalking around her house. You know, the house is set back from the road, away from the mailbox. Your postman normally just wouldn't be in a circumstance to see you sunbathing nude. Daly was violent. He had threatened people, including members of his own family, that he knew who had killed Daisy Zick, which is kind of a strange threat to make to someone, unless you're involved with this. And, the strangest thing of all, my wife and I both agreed on this, was, you know, the day of the crime, he came home and didn't tell his wife that he had been interviewed by the police about this.
Yeah.
And any one of us that had been pulled in even today, if someone pulled you in and interviewed you for an hour about a murder, it would be the first thing you'd tell your spouse when you got home.
Yet, what would his motive have been?
You know, we really don't have a motive. It could be that he was stalking her. It could be that Daisy refused his advances at some point and that upset him. We just don't know.
Yet she wasn't sexually assaulted. The zipper had been pulled at, but not quite.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep, she had not been sexually assaulted, but we don't know if that was tried and simply the events got out of hand or what. The truth is, the search for someone with a motive, which was really where the police kind of concentrated on, just didn't yield this. And it may be that the motive was just what may have been a perceived slight, to the wrong person.
Are you going to be making any appearances in Kalamazoo in Battle Creek, Blaine? Where can people...
Oh, yes. I've got a number of signings and events in Battle Creek the week of the 19th, as well as I'll be at the Barnes & Noble in Kalamazoo.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for talking to us, and it's a wonderful read, and I hope something comes out of this, you know, one of those tips or somebody's memory digs something up.
I think someone out there knows the truth and can help us bring closure to this crime, so I agree. I hope someone does step forward.
Well, thank you, Blaine, for talking to us.
Thank you.